Paul Levy is our guest, and we are talking about dispelling Wetiko. And awakeninthedream.com is the website where you can read more about this, Paul's website. And we were kind of ending off on the note of alchemy, Paul, and I want to continue, and there's so, just so much more to talk about there. When did you get into that? When did you tie alchemy into your work? Or have you always been interested in that, Paul?
Yeah, I've basically, you know, for me, how I got into my work, I mean, really at first was because I was so deeply suffering, and I just was like really open to anything that spoke to my suffering and was going to help me to alleviate it. And so that's why, you know, I got into Buddhism and then, you know, alchemy and Jung and shamanism and all that. And the more I studied, like, you know, whatever, alchemy, and I realized, as did Jung, I mean, he was the one who really taught me that, wow, what the alchemists, what they were really seeing, you know, the transformations that were happening in the hermetic vessel were actually reflections of what was happening inside of themselves. And some of the alchemists realized that and others didn't. But just as an artist, that really spoke to me. And so, yeah, I continually am, you know, my whole inquiry into stuff like alchemy or shamanism. And you know, I should also point out, not just as an academic or intellectual scholarly way, but this is something that, you know, in a full-bodied 24/7 way, I've been kind of involved in, you know, since 1980 or something like that. So for a long time, you know.
Very interesting.
And as I more and more, you know, deepen my inquiry, I more and more understand, oh my God, this stuff is like super profound and psychoactivating in that it's actually like a symbol system that's designed to really activate the psyche.
Yeah, so it's funny too, because a while back, this really kind of picked off into the mainstream, at least not maybe on the deeper level that you would think, but alchemy was kind of becoming something really cool again and a little hip, and there was a couple of books out on the subject, or quite many books on the more of the non-fiction type of books, of course, but even a novel came out called The Alchemist that allegedly sold really well and everything else like that. Mm-hmm. So I think there are... these things happen for a reason. Attention is brought to it within the unconscious because it knows that it's something that needs to be highlighted and discussed more. What do you think about the processes within alchemy? How they were developed? I guess where they actually really where they come from? Because there's some dispute there, of course, where we tie them back to. If we go back to Egypt, we tie them back to the Hermetic arts, as you talked about, of Hermes and everything else. Is that where you take them as well? Because they do follow Western civilization. That's really where they've been most popular, I guess, right?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I've, you know, all the traditions you just mentioned, and I guess for me, you know, I'm very eclectic. I'm very open to just whatever speaks to, like I was saying, speaks to my own suffering in a way that can help. And the one formal practice I do, when I do it every day for, you know, for long, many years, 30-something years, is Tibetan Buddhist practice. And Tibetan Buddhism really is totally alchemical. And like alchemy, it's totally the fundamental sort of source of the practice is the imagination. And if, you know, and this brings us back to Wetiko, because in a sense, Wetiko is an imaginal entity. It's a function of the imagination. And it can actually disable the imagination to the extent that we think, oh, I don't have a good imagination, or my imagination can't really affect my life. And, you know, and to fall, and that's to fall under Wetiko. And yet that can actually, the truth of that can manifest in the sense that if we actually believe that point of view, that Wetiko inspired point of view of, oh, I don't have a good imagination, that's what will actually manifest in our life as, like, we won't have a good imagination, which itself is an expression of the profundity of our imagination. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, and that's, you know, I'm talking about the imagination because ultimately that's really the basis of the whole alchemical opus, is connecting with the imagination of God through the alchemist. In other words, what the alchemist discovered is that, oh, wow, our own personal imagination somehow interfaces with the imagination of God in a way that's beyond imagination and something we can only imagine at the same time. And what they were pointing at was that there's a way of tuning in to what I call the sacred creative imagination, that where what we imagine actually influences what shows up in our life. And that's totally related to this being a dream, that when we connect with a dreamlike nature, you know, not like in a sense of being able to control the dream. Like people who say to me, oh, I have lucid dreams and I control the dream, right away I know, oh, they're not really lucid, at least fully lucid, because when you have full lucidity, you're not controlling anything. You're just allowing, you're being very spacious and allowing stuff to manifest and then consciously responding as compared to reacting against it, okay? So the point is that the imagination is of primary importance in our lives, in alchemy, and in really kind of coming to terms with Watiko.
Let me ask you a little bit about the great work. If this is something that you're describing here, that you've also caught on to, if you will, if you believe that this is something that the early alchemists realized and understood, that this is actually what it is about, or is it a coincidence because of the fact that no matter what we do, no matter what arts we develop or practices, it is going to hold within it the keys that is meant for solving some of our issues, if you know what I'm getting at, Paul, or is this very intentional? What do you think?
Right, and I think it depends on the individual alchemist, because the sense I have from my studies is that there were some alchemists who were really switched on and really had wisdom and understood what they had discovered and what they were tapping into, like the profundity of what they were accessing. And then, just like any spiritual practitioner, or any artist, there were alchemists who, maybe were still thinking, oh, I want to transform lead into gold and make money, or, they weren't quite fully tuned into, the profundity of what was getting reflected back to them about the nature of their own projective tendencies of their own psyche, and that they were actually having a dream. And the operations in the alchemical, sort of vessel were reflecting back to them the dreamlike nature. So some people, I think, some of the alchemists really more understood that than others,
Indeed. Let me ask you about this then, because we have one of the main tenets, solve a coagula, breaking things up and then putting them back together again. What's funny to me, Paul, in all this is also that Western civilization, with even the scientific field, is in many regards something that's seen as the root cause of all these problems, that it's, in some way an evil thing. But at the same time, if you zoom out, look at the bigger picture, you realize that this is what the alchemical process is about. Science has been about taking every little, atom. Where are we now? Down on superstring and M theory. We're like so deep into the parts now that this is something that wouldn't probably be possible without the scientific field, without, Western civilization being there. So although some people blame it, it is part of the alchemical process. That is what we've been seeing. I guess the main contention right now, though, is that we also need to have the coagula coming into the picture, the bringing together of the parts. We've been breaking them up for such a long time now that I think it's time to begin to, again, have a holistic view on things to be able to, make sense of them. What do you think about that, Paul?
I definitely feel that, too. I mean, on the one hand, the scientific materialist point of view underlies a lot of, a lot of the evil that's playing out. And at the same time, it's unbelievably beneficial. Now, just to connect this to Watiko, the thing about Watiko, it can take even the most beneficial aspects of our nature and sort of subsume them into itself so that it feeds its nefarious agenda. Okay, and this is a reflection of how Watiko works in the psyche, because, and I'm continually trying to, just as many ways as I can imagine to articulate what Watiko is, because that is the very thing that helps us to see it and take away its power. Like, so, for example, Watiko, you could say it's like when a pathological aspect of the psyche starts to take over all of the healthy parts of the psyche, so they get subsumed into its service. And they can appear, the person so taken over can appear normal, and yet the actual part of their psyche that's in the driver's seat is this pathological element, the Watiko element, and then all of the healthy parts are just its minions in a way. And that process that I just described is actually not only playing out individually in certain people's psyches in different ways, but it's playing out, out in the world. Because keep in mind, one of the things about whether it's alchemy or any of the mystical wisdom traditions is that they're always reflecting back the inner is the outer, And that's very much like a dream, because what is a dream but a reflection of the mind?
Indeed, and there are processes that goes on in there that we're not even aware of, and hence we do have nightmares, I would guess. We do have traumatic experiences in our dream world in some cases, because these are things that we either haven't dealt with, we haven't maybe understood them, but on a deeper level, we understand that it's a problem. It's something that we're struggling with. I mean, and you in the book also, you talk about some of your nightmares that you met Dracula or a vampire. You know, these examples come up, right?
Exactly, and they were, I interpret them as they were really embodiments of the Wetiko germ in myself, and in the dream I was given, you know, the arena to really to engage with those energies in a way where hopefully I was able to assimilate them to whatever degree. And the thing, one of the things you would just mention about like sort of with dreams, and we'll have like these nightmares, well, when we have a recurring nightmare, it's exactly as if some deeper part of us is trying to actually show itself to us, to give us a message. And to the extent we don't have the recognition of what is actually revealing to us, it, you know, that nightmare is guaranteed to, you know, to happen again and again in more amplified form. And how come I'm talking about this is that that's one way of understanding what's happening on our planet with all the, you know, the war and even like with the school shootings. And something is actually revealing itself to us when we view it symbolically, which is the language of dreams. But if we don't have the recognition of what's being revealed, then we're investing our energy in ensuring that the evil, you know, destructive effects are going to be continue to happen. And just one final thought about this, and that is the thing about Wetiko is that if we have the recognition of what it's revealing to us, that's when we unlock its blessing. And so everything depends on if we recognize what's being revealed through its manifestation. And if we don't recognize what's being revealed, if we think it's separate from us and objective, and if we project out the evil out there, then we're as much a minion of Wetiko as anybody else. Then we're feeding the bug. Then we're totally complicit in the evil that's playing out.
Tell us more about how these things are symbolic, Paul. The horrible events that goes on in our world, why are they happening? What's the message it's sending to us?
Yeah, and that, you know, I hesitate to interpret like, you know, any sort of a symbol, because the thing about when you have a dream, it's not a one-size-fits-all type of interpretation thing.
That's right.
Where somebody says, oh, you dream of this symbol, it means that. You see, the thing about symbols, I mean, if you really inquire into the nature of a dream doesn't exist in an objective, solid way, separate from your own consciousness. On the contrary, a dream is your own consciousness actually appearing to you. It's your own psyche appearing to you. And so what that means is that whatever symbol, and I should first define what a symbol is, it's different than a sign. When you have a sign like one way, do not enter, that's this has this literal meaning. You know, it's very clear. But a symbol is actually an expression, an emanation of some deeper reality that is actually pointing at that deeper reality, and it's actually a portal to that deeper reality. And a symbol is like the most it's like, you know, in a way the most crystallized expression of that mystery that it's an expression of. And at the same time, a symbol, it doesn't exist separate from yourself. So in a way, it's the interplay between your own unconscious psyche and this seeming, you know, outer, whatever whether it's a night dream or the waking dream. So it's actually tailor-suited just to your own process and to your own unconscious. And that's why it's so interesting. Just think about a night dream. On the one hand, it's a complete expression of your unconscious, of the part of you that's unconscious. And simultaneously, you know, if you look at a night dream, it's waking you up. It's actually speaking symbolically. So at the same time that it's an expression of your unconscious, it's also helping you to become conscious, and it's in a superposed state. Both are there simultaneously, you know? And so what I'm saying is that the way to understand, or one way of really getting more insight into Wetiko, is when you see this world as if it's a dream, you begin to discover, oh, wow, well, what is the language of dreams? It's symbols. I can actually begin to interpret my experience in a symbolic way, and that really just opens up. Then you see, the thing about Wetiko, it works through the perspective. When we understand things in like this literal, dogmatic, materialistic way, that feeds Wetiko. But when we all of a sudden understand that this world we live in is like an epiphany, it's like an oracle that's like this unfolding like revelation of itself that speaking dream speak, which is the language of symbols, then all of a sudden, once you see that, then all of a sudden you're not falling under the spell of Huatico, and at the same time you're actually being of benefit to the field.
Interesting. So does that to you, Paul, mean that we actually are in a dream? I mean, can we become lucid, if you will, and as some people say, then direct it, or as you said earlier, even more go with the flow of the dream? Or is the dreamlike nature of reality an example that you want to give to people so that they can understand what reality really is?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny because I was hanging out a little while ago with one of these, you know, really well-known Tibetan practitioner who's a translator. He's translated a lot of great texts, and we were having tea, and I was saying to him, oh, well, you know, this is a dream. Like right now, this isn't like a dream. It's not metaphorical. And he was saying, oh, no, this is like a dream. It's a metaphor. And that was it was the first time we were meeting and we really connected, but that was the one thing that I disagreed with. And how come I disagree with that is because going back to when I first began to wake up and was having my whole spiritual awakening in 1981 and the early stages, and I've spoken about this with you on past programs where I got hospitalized and diagnosed and told I was going to have this mental illness for the rest of my life. And, you know, it was a nightmare in a real way. But the experience that I was having was that I was having the recognition that we were all having this mass shared dream. This waking dream, and that stuff began happening in my life that was absolutely physically impossible, or so I thought, that was not supposed to be able to happen in this reality, but it was happening on a regular basis. And I was very fortunately connecting with my teachers, you know, these great enlightened beings from Burma and Tibet. And so while the psychiatrists were pathologizing my experiences in me, I would be sharing with my teachers these experiences, and they were actually reflecting back, oh, you're beginning to wake up. And so the point is that, yeah, when I say to recognize the dreamlike nature, yeah, this reality we're in, it's very dreamlike, and I'm not just using that in a metaphoric sense. I'm saying this is a dream, and just like in a night dream, when we wake up in the night dream and have lucidity, we can do that. That's available to us, and that's actually the whole point. That's what's being offered to us, and that's what Huatico is showing us through its really seemingly dark manifestations. That's what's actually being presented to us through Huatico.
I'm going to go back to symbols and synchronicity a little bit as well, because when you realize that there is meaning in something, when you perceive a symbol, or I mean, it can be anything, right? But it's all about if you understand if there is a meaning to it or not. But there is another aspect of that, and that it's, even if we don't get it, it doesn't mean that it's not speaking to us. I've had a few examples of people who continuously are having a certain experience, or they over and over are having a dream or something like that, or something happens to them, and I try to say, you know, whatever it is, so try to look at that, try to examine that, because it there's something there and it's trying to speak to you. That's probably why it's happening over and over and over again. In your view, Paul, how can one become aware of what these are? Let's say that we are symbolic illiterate. We don't understand what these things mean, or that they even speak to us. Is this something you think inherently we must have within us, or can one learn to kind of develop to read these symbols?
And I appreciate that question. And I would say, you know, the first thing, and probably even the best thing to do, is to connect with your night dreams, is to put a journal or a tape recorder by your bed, and to write down your dreams, and to, you know, have a dream journal, because, you know, the unconscious, all of a sudden, as soon as you do that, if you haven't done that before, it sees, oh, he or she is taking me seriously, and then it'll start to send you more profound dreams. And then you're beginning to be taught the language of dreams, you know, by actually putting your attention on your night dreams. But not only that, by all of a sudden beginning to become a little bit more intimate and fluent with your night dreams and how they actually speak to you symbolically, you begin to become more acquainted with the symbolic dimension of life. And you begin to realize, oh my God, the same deeper sort of this dreaming self that's dreaming my dreams at night is dreaming my life. You know, so I would say the real answer to your question is to really connect with your dreams. Now, one other thing too, see, the thing about Huatico, it's one way of understanding it. It's this a semantic disorder in that it actually co-opts the way we'll use language for our experience.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it'll then, it you know, in a perverse way, will distort, will have like meaning based on language, and it will play with that in a way that hides itself from being seen and actually will further, will serve its agenda. So what that means, and if you remember right at the beginning of this interview, I was saying, wow, what is Huatico? That's a hard question to form, to language, to find the words for. Well, what that's pointing to is the profound importance of creating a new language, or, you know, in a way, what I'm pointing at when I say that is the importance of creatively expressing ourselves through art. And I'm not just talking in a flatland version of making paintings or drawings. I'm talking about that each and every moment that this, that our canvas is our life, and that to the extent that we connect with our actual creative spirit and express our experience moment by moment creatively, that's in a sense energetically just totally dispelling Huatico, because Huatico, if it only can operate when it's not, but by not being seen, but also not being spoken, yeah, and not being, you know, just named or not being mapped. So any, you know, to the extent that any of us can, you know, just as artists, as these, we're like having dreams, and this world is our canvas to like unfold our sacred dreaming power or our sacred artistic creative power. That's all in the service of really helping to take away any sort of power of Huatico, both in our own psyche and in the world.
Very interesting. It's two different ways of thinking about this as well. I've heard both, and we can talk about them, because some people, mm-hmm, view the world of words as being something unreal, a fiction, that it's something that doesn't really exist. It's kind of, it's not, your name can't kick a football, for example. It's you, the flesh and blood version of you, that's doing it. Although at the same time, when someone is calling you, you're gonna become aware of that. So at the same time, you're being called by your name, you realize that it's describing you, so it catches your attention.
Right.
But there is an interface there, which I just think is interesting, because in the beginning of the book, Paul, you discuss basically the freedom to name things, and you talk about this idea of developing a new language that you just mentioned, or naming things, because it's a power that is held within that when you do call something, and it's also an interface between these two worlds. I mean, it's a way to associate a mental idea or about an image that we have of an object in our mental world about with something that actually exists out there in the real world. So, is Huatico? How do I phrase this? Is Huatico part of the world of words? Is it mental in that way, just a psychic, non-existent thing?
Yeah, no, I would say the thing about Huatico, it's in this intermediate realm that connects both matter and spirit. So it's between, you know, words in the abstract sense and actual, like, physical reality. You know, what you've been saying makes me think of the power of the word. You know, in the Bible, the very first saying is, you know, what was it? First was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And that's pointing at the profound importance of, when we connect with the power of the word, we actually connect with the part of us that's a creator, that there's something about language and speaking in words and the power of the word that actually is not just describing reality, but is invoking reality and actually creating reality. So when, you know, that has to, this has to do with, by finding the right name of the demon, by calling it Melanogophrenia or Huatico, it doesn't make a difference what name, as long as it's the right name, then all of a sudden there's a power to that. So I would just really emphasize that, yeah, on one hand, you know, you can't kick a football with words, but, you know, on the other hand, that there's some intrinsic and profound power that's actually embedded in our words and how we language our experience. And think about it, you know, with the power of art, how art can really affect people, where if somebody actually is making a work of art, a real genuine creative work of art, well, that work of art, be it a painting or a song or whatever it is, in a sense is infused with that person's energy, and particularly if in the creation of that work of art, that person becomes transformed through the expression of that creative spirit, through that work of art, that energy is in a sense transmitted through the work of art and can virally influence other people's unconscious who are open to that energy. And so, and that's really interesting because that's the way that Wetiko works, is it virally transmits through the unconscious, like these vectors through our unconscious just, you know, reinforce and infect other psyches. But what I'm saying is, you know, conversely, we can actually express ourselves creatively and create a new form of language, you know, art, in a sense that can actually be the antidote to the way that Wetiko, being a semantic syndrome, actually operates.
What makes Wetiko then the right name?
Well, okay, that's an interesting question. And, you know, and I guess the one thing that comes up, it's a term that the Native Americans would use for centuries. I mean, it's not anything like I've discovered this. I'm just trying to be a translator of this indigenous, you know, sort of this wisdom into a more modern idiom. And this is the word that they used. And, you know, I talk about this in the book that, well, the imagination I have, it's sort of like this, like when you repeat sort of a mantra, well, it doesn't have necessarily a conceptual meaning, but it has a vibration. And particularly when lots and lots of people over the course of history have, you know, repeated the mantra and had a certain sort of, whether it's a nonverbal meaning or, you know, just an energy to it, that word, that sound, that vibration gets imbued with a certain energy. And so at least in my imagination, I feel like, well, okay, I made up malignant egophrenia, you know, me disease. That's, if some people like that, they can use that. It doesn't make a difference what the name is. But I just, and I make a point of this in the book, I actually made a choice to use the word Wetiko based on the, you know, wanting to honor the indigenous cultures, you know, their traditions, this would be the word they would use. And I also, at least in my imagination, being that this is all a dream, I'm going to invoke my imagination that, well, in my imagination, that this word does have a certain, like, sort of mantric power to it.
I was in your website earlier as well, and we had a little write-up about, well, Sandy Hook pretty much, and of course, understandably, there are many people looking at this as being another false flag event, which is completely understandable. But I don't know if it takes away from the idea that you're trying to get make though with your write-up in a way. Will this keep on happening, these kinds of events, whether, again, if they're completely planned or if they're completely so-called organic or natural, whatever we want to call it? Will it continue to happen, do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, one way to investigate that question is to, you know, to assume the point of view of this being a dream. And what if this were a dream? And what if something is being actually shown to us by the forms of the dream that are actually an expression of something inside of ourselves? And if we don't recognize what's being shown to us, then we're guaranteeing that it's going to, you know, become like a recurring dream happening again and again in more and more, like, you know, even like in this amplified form, you know. And so, you know, one thing, just if I can go on a little bit of a tangent because it's really important, the thing about Wetiko, you see, Wetiko, I've been mentioning, oh, it hides itself. You know, we become like the instrument for it to, you know, to sort of covertly operate through us and then into the third dimension. The thing about Wetiko, it's a shape-shifting bug that will, you know, it's very fluid and it will shape-shift and assume our form and put us on. And interesting how put us on, it means to like fool us, but it also means to put us on like a suit of clothes.
Right.
So then once it shape-shifts and assumes our form, we then, if we're not awake to what's actually happened, we'll just assume whatever thought form or feeling or impulse we have, we just assume it's ours. And then we act on that impulse or that thought, or we identify with that thought. And all the while, if it's actually inspired by Wetiko, it's kind of like the image of like, here's Wetiko sitting in our seat. And then we then more and more become taken over by Wetiko and become, in a way, this instrument for it to possess us and to actually act itself out. So you see, that's another example that when we become tuned in to the wiles of Wetiko, not only what I just described is in ourselves, but getting back to what you were talking about with, you know, the shooting at the schools at Sandy Hook, as we more and more see, oh, wow, here's how it's operating out in the world, and here's how it's operating in myself, you know, that there's like not, they're not separate, you know, sort of these processes, but there's some sort of like this correlation between the inner and the outer, then as we more and more understand that and see that, that's definitely going to be taking away the energy for Watiko to implement its agenda and to play itself out, you know?
So how does this work? Is this something that will effectively, well, I don't know how to put it, scream louder and louder in order to get heard, to get understood or realized that it's, yeah, it's a real part of reality, if you will?
Yeah. That's what I mean when I say if you don't recognize what's being revealed, it'll just be a recurring dream that gets amped up more and more and more.
Yeah.
And, you know, like for me, the Sandy Hook thing was really, it was amazing for me because I'm out in like, there was a mall shooting right in Portland, Oregon, where I live, a couple of days before where two people got killed. And the day that the mall reopened, on that Friday, was the day of the Sandy Hook shooting. Mm. So for me, it really viscerally felt like, oh my God, I'm having a recurring dream. I can't believe this. And now not just two people are being killed, but like, you know, 26 or 27 people. And it just, and yeah, so, yeah. You know, that's the way it works. Now also I should, you know, because I'm trying, there are so many aspects of Watiko that I talk about in the book. And I just want people to like really, to see what I've written, because I feel, and people who've read the book are saying, oh my God, this is really, really helpful for people. The thing about Watiko, so it's not a personal energy. It's a transpersonal and archetypal energy. One could say it's this daimonic energy. And that's an interesting word when you study the etymology of the word, because the daimon is actually the inner meaning, is the inner voice or the guiding spirit. And it's related to the genius, to genie. I dream of genie, the old TV show. It's related to the words calling and finding one's voice and vocation. So the point is, now encoded in the daimonic is the creative spirit. And so the point is that if we connect with that, with the daimonic energy, and the daimonic being transpersonal, the way it works, it literally will take over a person, or a group of people, or a nation, or a species, and they become the channel through which it operates, it acts itself out through those people so possessed. And then, if we're unconscious of that daimonic, it actually becomes negative and becomes demonic. It becomes a demon. Now, but if we tune in to that creative spirit that's encoded in the daimonic, you know, in the inner voice, the guiding spirit, we'll find our genius, and we'll find our genie, and find our calling, and connect with our voice, and find our vocation, which is what we're here to do. And so it's just really interesting when you study the etymology of these words, you can really show us something. And I guess one final point about this whole discussion is, psychologically, there's a phrase called an autonomous complex, which really has to do with a part of the psyche that's split off due to some form of trauma, and then it'll develop a seemingly autonomous like life or this will of its own. And the indigenous, and you know, an autonomous complex is another way of describing Watiko, and it's actually fundamentally a part of the wholeness of our psyche. And the indigenous people, what they would call autonomous complexes would be a demon. And so it's interesting how the word demon and daimon, and you know, they're all related. And when you really study the etymology of it, it really, I feel, sheds light on this deeper process that's going on.
Indeed. Let me read something from the book here. It's under the curse of pessimism, which I think is an interesting point as well. Through mm-hmm. the big lie, which is based on the principle that the bigger the lie, the harder it is for people to see the truth. The government has transformed myth into something fact, into seeming fact, and has achieved its goal of muddling our minds as to make us feel powerless, thereby inspiring deep pessimism regarding our future. To be pessimistic and think that we can't change the trajectory of our species' suicidal, trance-like behavior is to be under the spell of Watiko, as if we have fallen under a demon's curse. And this is a really good point, because again, it goes back to this idea that also governing bodies that want to control us on a mass scale they want us to be dependent on them, as we need them, and they work with pessimism basically as well. That no point. You can't fight them. It's kind of useless. So how does one break out of that, the pessimism that is so prevalent right now?
Right. No, and that's a great point. And I make the point in the book that there's this war going on, but it's not the war that we think is going on. It's a war on our consciousness. Okay.
Exactly.
And, you know, and it's really another way of describing, talking about Watiko. And the thing is one of the maladies I see a lot of really good people suffering from is they feel helpless or impotent or powerless, you know, with reference to changing what's happening. And then they just sink into a sense of not only despair, but of just feeling numb and all that. And they'll assume a pessimistic point of view. Oh, there's nothing I can do. And what I point out in the book is that if you actually assume a pessimistic point of view and fall into pessimism, then you're going to, whatever's happening in the world, you see through the lens of pessimism, which then, it's really important to understand this. And one way of understanding this is going back to the dream. If in a dream, if I hold a viewpoint in a dream, being that the dream is nothing other than a reflection of my own mind, if I hold a pessimistic viewpoint, the whole dream will instantaneously shapeshift and reflect back all the evidence I need to confirm my pessimism.
Yeah.
And now I have proof. So then I'm even more entrenched in my pessimistic point of view. And the more I hold that pessimistic point of view, the more I will invoke a world that will give me the justification to be pessimistic in a feedback loop that I'm actually creating. So you see, the thing about Watiko, it actually, we are these creative, like, geniuses. And yet Watiko will usurp our own creative genius for how we create reality in a perverse way to feed itself. And one way of understanding that, it's like a tapeworm.
A psychic tapeworm, as you say, yeah.
Yeah, it's a psychic tapeworm. I talk about that in the book. When a tapeworm gets into our system, it will secrete chemicals so that we start to crave food that feeds the tapeworm.
Sugar,
and it grows
wheat.
Bigger.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, exactly. It grows bigger as it kills us, the host,
yep.
You know? Now, and one other thing about to answer your question about what to do about, like, the pessimism. And there's a beautiful image. When you have, if you take sugar, grains of sugar, and just one by one, just put them in a glass of water and just dissolve them in the water, they'll just dissolve and dissolve until you reach the saturation point. And then you add one more grain of sugar and a crystal will manifest. And the point being that any one of us self-reflecting in this moment, having the recognition of the dreamlike nature, seeing our own shadow, seeing Watiko, could be that very grain of sugar that precipitates a change in the entire collective unconscious.
Yeah.
Okay? So I think it's really important to actually assume that we are that potential grain of sugar right now. And that's just not some sort of like myth or like this woo-woo thing. That's totally based on the whole the non-local nature of reality and of consciousness.
So Watiko also feeds on our energy. That's obviously at this stage, and we are effectively making it alive by, if it's a psychic tapeworm, then it's by our thoughts, what we think is possible, what is not, etc. It's all a feedback loop, and this is also interesting to me because it ties in with so many other things that other authors and guests on this program has talked about. In some cases, it's viewed upon as a race of you know, inorganic beings, what have you. But it's, to me anyway, mm-hmm. is describing very, very much the same thing. It's different words and somewhat of a different kind of outline on it. But it's there's a lot of people onto this trail right now, which is very interesting to me.
Right. No, totally. And whether it's Castaneda talks about the flyers or the archons of the Gnostics, they're all, you know, it makes no difference what the name is, as long as it's like you're pointing at, you know, we're all pointing at the same thing. And what I'm actually pointing at is that whether you call it Watiko, whether you call it ME disease, malignant egophrenia, whether you call it a vampire or a virus or a tapeworm, a parasite, a cannibal, you know, they all shed light on a particular aspect of Watiko, and they all don't show the whole. But when you put them all together, all of those like symbols or metaphors or, you know, just different, a way of perceiving, Watiko, they all complement and shed light on each other, and it gives us a higher, like, a resolution or a focus of what actually we're dealing with, you know? So, yeah, I think so many people are on, you know, in Castaneda, Don Juan calls this topic the topic of topics.
Yeah.
It is the most important thing. I hear all the, you know, every, over the course of time, people are like, oh, so and this billionaire is given like $10 billion to do, to help poverty or research cancer. And I'm thinking, wow, that's fantastic. And what about somebody, you know, really supporting and investing lots of money in bringing light to this research? Because this is underlying the poverty, the cancer, all of those things. The really essential fundamental process is the origin of it is our own psyche. And that's not being, you know, studied very much, but more and more and more, as time unfolds, more and more and more people are awakening to this and are getting switched onto it and are turning their attention to it, which is a really good thing. And that helps to dispel pessimism, because when you realize, wow, I have all the seeming evidence to confirm a pessimistic point of view, but yet so many people are awakening, that can really help to inspire like a real positive optimism.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's a shame to see so much money out there as well being poured down the drain. I think it's also done temporarily to look good in media. It's all about PR. They don't really care about it. They feel better maybe doing it, and it's a lot of do-gooders
right,
out there.
Right, they can sleep better.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's so, as you said, so many research programs, so much important stuff happening out there that does not get funded or supported in any way at all. I mean, the medical establishment, we know, again, there's an agenda and a conspiracy behind this to keep people dependent, you know, keeping them dependent on medicine and drugs and everything else. And I mean, that's just the way it is. But if there was genuine rich donors out there, begin to look into some alternatives here, because it's obviously not working. The endless amounts of money are being poured into a black hole and nothing ever changes. What you're talking about here, Paul, is striking at the root of the problem. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And actually, just to go back to one thing that you had just said a little while ago, one of the ways Watiko works is through our thoughts. And there's nothing intrinsically that's negative or that's bad about our thoughts. It's the nature of our mind to have thoughts, in the same way that an ocean has waves. And the waves are the unmediated expression of the ocean, right? So the waves are, you know, negative or pathological, in the same way that thoughts aren't, you know, of necessity anything negative or pathological. But what Watiko will do, it will inspire us to actually identify with our thoughts.
Yeah.
And I think about, like, you know, in the sayings of the Buddha, the Dhammapada, the very first saying, the Buddha said something like, we create this reality with our thoughts. And when you think about thoughts or thought forms, they're like dreams. When you have a thought form, if you identify with the thought as compared to just seeing, oh, it's just a thought, it's not necessarily even real, but it's, you know, it has a certain reality, but it's not really real in a real way. You know, if we just think of it, so if we identify with the thought, then just like a dream where we get absorbed in, we actually will materialize that dream into, and will become absorbed in the dream and identified with the dream. In the same way that if we identify with our thought forms, we will all of a sudden incarnate that very thought form as being, you know, the reality. Like if I have a thought, oh, I am depressed, well, that's just a thought. But if you all of a sudden have an identification with that thought and invest your awareness in that thought, you're going to create a universe where you're going to manifest the truth of that thought, where you will be depressed. Now, the point being is that, so Watiko will inspire our whole relationship to our thinking in a way where our thinking in a way plays with us, where we become in a way sort of this victim to our thoughts, compared to when you get turned on to that, oh wow, there's this phenomenon called thoughts, and there's actually spaciousness in which the thoughts are actually arising and in which they effortlessly just self-liberate if I just don't do anything except to just allow them to just express their nature, which is emptiness, and Buddhism is called emptiness. Then all of a sudden, you can play with your thoughts in a way where you can create with your thoughts instead of having your thoughts create you. Okay? Yeah. And that's, once again, to cut the spell of Watiko.
Very good. I wanted to return as well to one point, because we have the flip side of pessimism that we talked about, and that well, tell us about the curse of over-optimism.
Right. Yeah. No, totally. Because, you know, and that's just as much of a curse or falling under the spell of Wetiko as pessimism, because, you know, I know people, very well-intentioned, good, spiritual people who say, oh, there's nothing to worry about, God will take care of everything, and, you know, everything's in perfect order. And I would say to them, yeah, you're right, everything is perfect, totally perfect, and it's suboptimal beyond belief. And if you're just like sitting there just passively in this waiting mode for some sort of messiah or a savior figure to come down and save you, that's to totally miss the mark, which is the inner meaning of the word sin. You know, the point is that, yeah, we actually are the participatory agents in our own evolution, and we are the dreamer, the co-dreamer of the dream. So in other words, we ourselves are a dream character of the deeper dreaming self. We're being dreamed by this deeper dreaming self, while in a circular, nonlinear, atemporal, acausal process, we are dreaming up this dream simultaneously that we're being dreamed by it, okay? And, you know, and one way of understanding this is, like, even with two people, you have a relationship, and, like, one person is actually dreaming up the other person to manifest in a certain way, but the other person is, in a sense, dreaming you up to dream them up that way, and vice versa. The point being that that's in that intermediate realm between people, that bardo, that's the arena that Wetiko manifests. And so it's a dreaming phenomena. And being a dreaming phenomena, and this all of this world is a dreaming phenomena. This is a Mashar dream. That's what I've been saying in different ways. When you discover that, you realize I'm the dreamer. We all are the dreamers. We can actually realize that and put our dreaming together in a way to change things, as compared to just waiting for some sort of like off-planet deity or a messiah figure, you know, to come and save us. And that's to fall under the over-optimistic curse I talk about. And that's just to completely fall under Wetiko. And it's tragic because, you know, so many of these people are well-intentioned, but they're just sort right. of, in a way, you know, whatever, just their understanding is sort of misguided. And, it's a shame.
Yeah, well, the way I see it on this as well is that it... It's what I see is someone taking themselves out of the equation. I think we have gotten an awareness that we have for a reason. We have become aware of what we have because we are there in a position then to do something about it. So if we take ourselves out of the picture and think right. that without our interaction or work things would, you know, magically fix themselves, that's not true. But we're in there. We're in the equation. We're part of the dream right. of reality, whatever you have.
Right.
And we have the awareness that we have for a reason. So now do something about it. Act on it. Be that, you know, change if you want to, you know, see it that way. Become that change you want to see in the world, because now you have, well, the way I see it is that you have the responsibility when you have the awareness of it. Don't tell anyone yeah. else, do this or change that or, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Again, it's just exactly. externalizing it. We have to realize that we have been given this awareness for a reason, or we found it. We came looking for it. Yeah.
Right. And the thing is, because I see this, you know, with some really good people who are these spiritual practitioners. Oh, they don't want to, you know, like, for example, there's a, you know, the spiritual bookstore in town here. They wouldn't carry my previous Wetiko book. And I give talks there a couple times a year for 20-something years. And they wouldn't even carry the book because they saw it as like, oh, it's about evil. We don't want to have anything to do with evil. So, you know, and they're good people. But the point is that it's what I was talking about before, is that, you know, by actually having an avoidance of the darkness and anything that that entails, they're unwittingly feeding it. You know?
Yeah.
And so I actually talk about this exact episode in the book. And what the point I make is that, okay, if we avoid taking a look at evil and coming to terms with evil as it's manifesting in the dream all around us as it is today, we're unwittingly feeding the very evil that we're avoiding. But if we become overly fascinated with it, that's also to be feeding it. But there's a third option. And the third option is to see the evil, is to see Wetiko, is to see how it operates. And then when you see it, you can choose, how do I want to invest my attention? Because I'm a sovereign being. And I can invest my attention on, what about creating the world I want to live in? That's how I can invest my attention. And that is the very point of view that dispels Watiko.
And how do you see that? Is that to do more with your immediate surrounding, or is it about trying to change the global perspective about how someone lives in a country we've never visited before?
Well, that's an open-ended question. There's not one answer to that. Like, you know, say, for example, okay, like as an artist, I'm actually creating an art happening called art, it's called Art Happening called Global Awakening. And it's basically, you know, there's free membership, it's full benefits for all. And what it's about, when people ask, what is the Art Happening? What is this? I say, well, what would you imagine it to be? What if you were to wake up in the dream fully right now, right? And you've discovered, oh my God, this is all a dream. And then you look around and you see all your other dream characters, and a lot of them are absorbed in the dream and not realizing, you know, who they are, not recognizing the dreamlike nature. The point being that, well, it wouldn't be a fully satisfying awakening unless everybody wakes up, until everybody gets it. Because if there's one person who's still asleep, well, then I'm still asleep. That's that part of me. And how so, one does...
Sorry to interrupt, but that doesn't mean it's not the 100th monkey scenario with the sugar coagulating that you mentioned before. It's not just mm-hmm. coming to that point. You're talking about everybody has to be on board with this thing.
Well, but the thing, yeah, I mean, it's both and, in the sense that there's a certain, like, a critical sort of mass that maybe might be reached. Even in the book, in like the Revelations, the Book of Revelations, they'll talk about this symbolic 144,000, which can be read as like a symbol when the 100th monkey happens. But so it might not entail that everybody might, you know, have the full awareness, but if enough people have it, it changes the collective unconscious of the entire species.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole point is, it's like the bodhisattvic point of view. So the bodhisattva is somebody who's they're attaining enlightenment, they're about to enter into nirvana, and then they look around themselves and they see all their fellow suffering brothers and sisters. They make the bodhisattva vow, going, I'm not going to enter into nirvana until everybody else enters first. Because at that moment, if they're genuinely enlightened, they realize, oh my God, who is everybody else but just parts of myself? And so then they commit themselves to being of service. And interestingly, paradoxically, it's by stepping out of our own fixation on our own narcissistic self, and by actually being of service to others, and in a way, you know, forgetting about ourselves, that's the very way that we actually connect with the truth of who we are, and simultaneously to alleviate our own suffering by actually helping other people.
Hmm. What do you think would change if this awakening happened, if this realization happened? How would this change the world, Paul?
Yeah, and that's, you know, I'm you ask, you know, really interesting questions, because I'm not sure how I would answer that. I would just invoke the imagination, like, how would we imagine that would look, you know? And because, you know, this is this work in progress that we're all co-dreaming together. And so from one point of view, a part of me wants to say, just to be playful, that realization has already happened, that we as a species have already woken up in the atemporal higher dimension of our being, and that all of what's being played out as history is the medium through which we're actually having that realization in time. We're, you know, from the atemporal dimension, we've already had that realization, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting aspects in the book, a lot of things that, you know, we haven't gotten to yet, of course. But, well, in the last few minutes or so that we have, Paul, is there anything else you feel is important, or something you really want to, you know, get out there before we round things up at this time?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And, yeah, I would just, you know, I mean, the whole point of me writing this book was I felt like, oh my God, I found, you know, why I'm here on the planet. I really, now that it's actually published, I really have a strong sense of, oh my God, this is one of the reasons, this is like one of the reasons I'm incarnate right now. And, you know, I'm not doing this at all for the money type of thing. I just want people to really to study this, because it feels like what I'm actually pointing at, and I'm not the only one, there are a lot of other people who are in their own way are pointing at the same thing.
Sure,
it's something, yeah. I feel that's so, like, profoundly, like, you know, just important. And even as I'm saying that, I feel like so kind of a frustration with language. And, you know, because what can happen in the book, I talk about Watiko. When you find the name, you actually really connect with the power of an idea, because the name is actually pointing at the idea of Watiko. And like I talk about that, like, you know, when you have like, you know, say like these dictators, these fascist dictators in history, one of the things that a lot of them are most afraid of is the power of a new idea, you know. And Watiko is a magical idea. It has the experience I have is that it has this unbelievably intrinsic like power to it. And when more and more people actually begin to kind of have it be part of their language and vocabulary, and as the word more and more gets out and people, not just the word, but what it's pointing at, the non-locality of Watiko and the dreamlike nature and the non-local field and what this means about who I am, that I'm not separate, I'm interconnected and interdependent, you know, as that begins to sort of spread through, you know, like a virus, but sort of like a meme, but in a positive sense, where all of a sudden it will really dissolve the Watiko meme, the negative aspect of it, and that can actually really be in the service of a total, like, evolutionary sort of awakening of our species. And so, yeah, I just, my hope and prayer, you know, is that this work really gets out. It's something I've devoted my 30-some-odd years to. And, yeah, so I guess that would be really, you know, I mean, what comes to mind.
All right, really good stuff. Well, there's obviously a lot of work to do. I think you've begun that journey very well, Paul, of course, of detailing your experiences and also weaving in your ideas into it. And I have a feeling it's just beginning as well for you at the same time, although it's like I said before, you're also crystallizing this all the time, and you become better at explaining it and understanding it and diagnosing it. And I mean, by no means.
Could I just say one word about that?
Sure,
what you're saying?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, because, you know, in the beginning of the book, I talk about this in an earlier book, that I had this dream. It was the day that two of my spiritual teachers were coming to visit me. And that morning I had an incredible dream where me and a bunch of people, we were on the lookout for a vampire. And we were all actually chanting Bela Lugosi, Bela Lugosi in the dream together. And then I see Dracula. I see him. And I point him out to all the other people in the dream who are also trying to find him. And no one else can see him except for me. Well, what I've the understanding I have as I've written this book and as my work gets more polished and become like more articulate and fluent is that I'm developing language to more and more point out the vampire to other people in a way that they can see it. And that's in a way what the book is.
Yeah, it's good. It's like pointing out the illusion of a magician or something like that. How is the trick done?
Exactly.
Right? You have to get it into your awareness in order to see it. And and also to comment on what you said before there, by the way, I mean, we have had people like Brzezinski. He's talking about a fear of a what he calls a mass global, you know, political awakening. And ultimately, you know, what they're afraid of in that sense is, as you said before, it's both words on paper, but also the fact that those words on paper actually yield ideas in the head of people, thoughts or opinions,
right?
And ideas. That's where we're going at now. This is basically they're banning everything they can, left, right, and center, to be able to prevent people from growing and understanding. But there's nowhere they can turn now. Everything is going to lead us to a greater realization of what really is going on. And although that picture is turning out really ugly. It's kind of like Watiko in itself as well. It shows us the negative side, the dark side of what you know, control and regulation in that sense, and you know, leads to. And as that happens, people become aware to it and they wake up to it. And when they do that, they open up a whole new, you know, can of worms. A whole new world appears to them. And I think from there, I think we can actually start to go into something more positive as a human race, something more creative, and beginning to look at the potentials instead of trying to prevent people all the time and hold them back and everything else. So,
right.
You know,
no, that's so beautiful. Yeah, that's right on. Totally.
All right. Well, let's wrap up for this time again then. Anything else, by the way, Paul, on your website you want to talk about? Again, the URL for that is awakenintheDream.com. You have a glossary of terms there as well, by the way, to kind of go hand in hand with the book.
Right. I have that in the back of the book, and this also, the glossary of terms is on the website. And so if people want to, you know, check out the website, there's a ton of articles all about the stuff just for free. And then you can buy the book, you know, and I'm paying for shipping and I'll autograph it. And awakeninthedream.com. And yeah, no, it's just been a pleasure. I always enjoy talking with you. So thank you so much.
Same to you, Paul. Thank you so much for your time. Dispelling Wetiko. Go and check it out. Pick up a coffee if you want to read more and hear more about these ideas. Really good stuff. All right. Well, thank you, Paul. Really appreciate it. We'll wrap up for this time and we'll be back soon. And we hope you come away with new ideas while listening, or at least a realization that you don't agree with the assertions made during a program. This, at the very least, shows that you have rejected something because of other evidence, or a strong belief perhaps, and that this weighs stronger and is more important to you. And this is how we come to a conclusion, and it's very valuable to be able to weigh it against other claims in an effort to test them, if you will. So, as we've said many times before, it's not about agreeing. We learn by listening to each other, reading and exchanging ideas, but it's ultimately you who are at the center of your own understanding. And it's about a realization process of what you think. It's about you, no one else, or what other people think about what you think. So thank you for listening today. We'll be back with more soon, bringing you more interesting ideas, things worth considering. Have a good day wherever you are, and we'll talk more soon.